ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's hard to get your loved ones to change their habits, let alone change world history. But that's exactly what happened with apartheid.
A demonstrator has run right through the play.
Australians and millions of others took a stand and helped to bring the racist South African regime to its knees. I'm Sisonke Msimang, and join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Book Show, where today you are going to see Pakistan through the eyes of a writer in Norway and Switzerland, courtesy of an author here in Australia. I'm Claire Nichols, and today authors are writing about their homelands and places very far away, starting with Danielle Mouinadoun. Now, Danielle's novel is kind of like four books in one. It's called This Is Where the Serpent Lives, and it's four interlinked stories set in Pakistan, introducing us to a wonderful cast of characters, farmers, landowners, gangsters, and servants. It's an epic book, but here's the good news. It is easy to read too. It's about class and power and ambition, and I tore through this. Danielle Mouinadoun, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Now, you have a farm in Pakistan, in South Punjab. Tell me about this place.
Yeah, so sort of at the edge of the desert, in the Thar Desert, it's a land that my family acquired a long time ago, back in 1916, when this was still a part of the Bahawalpur state. And my father, it was desert land, which you in Australia probably understand, and it's about 13 hours in those days by road. And so he sort of gave me the choice to either come back and take care of it or to not, with the proviso that if I didn't, it was going to be lost to the guys who were running it for him, over these managers. So in 87, I went back to take over the place and have been sort of in and out, but running it ever since.
And when you say come back, where were you coming back from, Danielle?
Oh, right. And when I was 13, I was sent off to boarding school in America. So went off to boarding school, then went immediately to college in America. So I'd been away from the age of 13 until the age of roughly 24 in America, and was, you know, therefore didn't have sort of the cultural knowledge that I needed to do to run this place. As you can imagine, it's fairly challenging way out in the districts of Pakistan, and especially in those days, there were no communications at all. Our telephone number was 27, and that in order to call Lahore, I had to book the call, and then we'd have to wait hours and hours, and often as not, it wouldn't go through. And there was absolutely no question of calling abroad. So I was properly isolated for many years there, which was kind of wonderful. I used to write endless letters to my girlfriend in New York City, who was receding more and more distant from me as the years passed, and I was spending most of my time at the farm. Yeah, so that's how I ended up there. And then, you know, it was a wonderful place for me. I went there very much with the intention or the understanding I wanted to write, and I thought of it as a perfect place to write, just because A, I would have a lot of time, and B, I would, you know, just have a lot of exposure to life. I mean, I was smart enough, even in my 20s, to realize how clueless I was in terms of having any understanding of, you know, life.
I'm thinking about you, this, you know, almost a kid, you're probably not used to getting your hands dirty. Like, how clueless were you when you first arrived on the farm?
I was merely a runny-nosed bachelor of the arts. and I'd taken a very useful degree. I was in English literature, studying the poetry of James Merrill, but that was my thesis. So I was really really clueless. I was dreamy and vague and studying poetry and reading poetry and writing poetry. So yeah, I was beyond clueless when I showed up. Knew nothing about farming. And even my Punjabi was pretty iffy, you know, because in Lahore, we all spoke Urdu. They're obviously very closely cognate languages, but you know, it really matters out there. The way they separate the sheep from the lambs is who speaks Punjabi. You can't get by there without speaking Punjabi. It's because that's the lingo. So it was very much a steep curve. And there were these incredible characters who were running the place, who'd been robbing my father blind for many years. And increasingly, you know, he was unwell and living in Lahore. They knew he couldn't come and deal with it. I mean, he was, you know, 13 hours away without a telephone. It's not very easy to take care of your property. And Pakistan is a notoriously difficult place to run a business anyway, and certainly land. And it was kind of gangster country out in those days. I mean, there was still, you know, cattle theft was a big issue. When I showed up, there were, you know, 20, 25 span of oxen still that we were using to for certain farm operations. It was a, yeah, it was an interesting time. And as it turns out, excellent training for a writer. I mean, there's nothing better than to be, I'm more a manager than I don't drive a tractor or anything like that. So didn't get my hands dirty in that sense, but it was a great training ground for getting to know people and getting to understand the place. And then hearing all these amazing stories, it was this incredibly vivid place of sort of the Wild West, and less now, although it's still very wild, but in a very different way. So I've watched it evolve, and that's what the stories are about, and that's where the stories are drawn from.
Yeah, certainly the two novellas specifically set out in the country on farmland in this book, they talk a lot about the tensions that exist within the community, say, between the landowners and the community. You know, there's kind of the remnants of this feudal system and, you know, people are supposed to kind of bow down to the landowners. Were you aware of those politics when you arrived back at the farm in 87?
Well, that... a lot of what I had to learn was the codes, you know, which are incredibly complex, just as they are anywhere, but much more unfamiliar there. It's sort of a tribal society, especially then, very much. It was all very formal and sort of kabuki-like, it, or at least seemed so to me at the time. The problems were problems of trying to understand what lay beneath the surface of everything, because there was so much laying beneath the surface. There was a lot of pretended deference to me and a lot of barely concealed opposition to me and the constant sort of a feeling of threat, because these guys were obviously not very thrilled that I'd come back. My brother and I had been sent off to school abroad at age 13. He was 14. And then we basically, you know, we would come back every summer and we would, I loved hunting in those days. And at the farm, there's nothing. It's all been shot. But it was wonderful hunting. And so we would come back in the summers and we'd run around in the desert. We would go up to the mountains. And, you know, we were continued to be engaged, but not in the business side of it, nor the political side. I don't take part in politics, which is very unusual for a landowner in that part of the world. But certainly I had to, you know, I'm politics adjacent. And I needed to learn to, you know, maneuver through all those complexities also.
How much time do you spend on the farm now?
More than you would think, given that I'm based in Oslo. I mean, I just got back, you know, a week ago, and, you know, I go regularly. I mean, what's strange is, believe it or not, what really changed my farming and made it much easier is Zoom and the internet. When the pandemic came along, like everybody else, I was stuck in England, and I was trying to figure out how the hell to keep tabs on my farm. And so we set up sort of a studio there, and managed to get very good internet I had to set up a link, you know, it was very complicated. You had to bought all these weird Chinese equipment with repeaters. And again, in Australia, you're probably familiar with this. So we had to set up this huge pole and put up dishes and then another dish in the city and then et cetera, et cetera. And set up like a proper studio with a big screen and a microphone. And when I first started doing this, the managers just couldn't believe it when first time I popped up on this ginormous screen in front of them, and they sort of sit in this room, and there'd be, you know, one or two or three or more of them sitting, and I'm projected on the screen, and they just couldn't believe it that I was, you know, so present. But so we have these daily meetings whenever I can. I spend a lot more time farming than I do writing, for sure.
So you're a virtual farmer.
I'm a virtual farmer. I know. Now all of your audience is laughing. They're saying, right.
Virtual farmer, sometimes writer, but then you're based in Oslo. So tell me what brought you to Oslo.
Back in 2005, I was doing a Fulbright scholarship. I was in school in America, and then I'd gone back to do a master in fine arts. Applied for the Fulbright. I'm strangely enough, I'm 25% Norwegian.
Oh.
My American mother, her mother was 100% Norwegian. And when I was little, we also own a farm in Wisconsin, which is where her people were from. And we used to go every summer, and my grandmother and my great aunt Viola, who were these very, you know, they spoke Norwegian with each other and were just one generation removed from this tiny little fishing village in Western Norway. You know, these two wonderful old biddies spoke Norwegian among themselves, and we'd be served krumkaka, which is a kind of cake, and all these other things. And my brother and I found, you know, we're fascinated by them and just from the whole Norwegianness of them. And so when I was at some, I'd always wanted to come to Norway. And so I took the Fulbright and came here for a year. It's this wonderful program where you come and you're given money. And I was attached to the University of Oslo and had an office there. And in the course of this, met this wonderful woman whom I, one thing led to another. We're now separated and divorced, but we live close to each other. We have little kids. And the reason I have to live here is because I have a 7-year-old and 11-year-old. I have them half the time, and they're at school here in Oslo. So I'm, for the first time in my life, I'm obliged to live in one place.
Wow.
Which is interesting to, at my age, to be tied down in that way. But I, you know, it's fascinating here. It's culturally is almost unfamiliar as South Punjab. As anybody who's ever met a Norwegian will tell you, they're not like the rest of the Europeans.
I do wonder what it's like to sit in Oslo and to write a story so specifically about Pakistan. Does the distance help?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, you know, one of the central facts of my life has been, you know, this code switching thing where you go to another place and you instantly are transformed into that other person, because the person I am when I'm in Pakistan, and particularly when I'm at my farm, is radically different than the person I am when I'm, you know, running around Oslo. You know, just all of my manners, and people who visit me in my farm remark on how different I am when I'm there. I think it is useful, yes, to look at a place. You know, the famous Joyce admonition of, for the artist, what you need is silence, exile, and cunning. He talks of those being the necessary qualities to write well. And in Oslo, silence is easily come by. Cunning, I have to supply myself. But the exile is, I think he's correct. I think it's really useful to be far away and both removed from the place and sort of longing for the place. Mm. I mean, even though I go back very often, you know, when I'm there, you know, when I go and live there for long periods, which I occasionally do, although now it would be difficult because of my children. No, I'm there and I love it. And then after a while, it just becomes too much. And it's just, Pakistan is so, it's just an onslaught of sort of color and vividness and dirt and dust. And it's this incredibly colorful, brilliant place. And it becomes too much. And then after a while, I sort of pull back and come over here. And then after a few months over here or less, then suddenly this place seems very bland and antiseptic, and one is hungry to go back. And so, yes, it's useful being abroad, absolutely.
You said hungry. I was about to say that I think you miss the food, Danielle, the way you write about food in this book. and, you know, just the samosas and the eggs fried in ghee. Oh, gosh, I was absolutely salivating.
Yeah, it's true, actually. They say, what is patriotism but the love of the fine things we ate when we were children?
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that patriotism enters through the belly just like love does.
So this book, This Is Where the Serpent Lives, it's, I just said in the introduction, it's kind of like four interlinked stories in one novel. How did you land on this shape?
Well, my first book is 8 connected stories, but not anywhere near as closely connected as these ones. You've probably read Faulkner, and Faulkner has famously created this, you know, Yoknapatawpha County in Missouri, where all of the stories that he's written are more or less creating this whole canvas, which describes that place very thoroughly. And I always thought that I wanted to do that in my stories for Pakistan. Even I started writing fiction very late. I'd always written poetry, so I started writing fiction in my 40s. And in the first book, did that. And then, so I was thinking already about having the whole thing, all of my work, be part of one large canvas. everything that I intend to do for the rest of my life. And then when I was, you know, began working on this book, it soon became evident to me that my subject, I was quite clear on my subject right from the beginning, which was going to be about, my first book was sort of about women's power. Mm-hmm. And this one is very much about men's power and about, you know, status and power and the issues that adhere around that. And as I started thinking about how to do that, this they say that the form needs to meet the subject and that, you know, there's a more or less ideal forms for any subject. And I think this form of these sort of loosely connected, very large stories that are sort of, they don't fit together in any neat way, but then Pakistan doesn't fit together in any neat way. And to describe something as complex as what I'm trying to describe, there's a lot of shorthand by jumping around. I don't have to write a whole, you know, 250-page book, I think would have almost been too much. It would have been too heavy, especially for contemporary appetites. I mean, people have such short attention spans. I think you also need to have, in a way, because of the way in which people's reading habits have changed, you need to give them something that surprises them much more. You can't write, you know, a novel in four volumes as they would in the 19th century. And this is rough and surprising as a form in a way that I hope will enable my readers to actually get through the damn thing because it's so long. You know, it's long. It's not that long. But it's, you know, 250 pages. Most people are accustomed to, you know, one iPhone screen worth of information at a time. So I'm already out making a big ask with the four novellas.
I can guarantee this book is absolutely readable. I did tear through it. The first character we meet, he's an orphan boy. He's clutching a pair of shoes. He's sitting in a bazaar in a city in Pakistan. His name's Bayazid or Yazid. Tell me about this kid.
So Yazid is one of, I mean, there's, I mean, the your mother is supposed to love all her children or a father is supposed to love all his children equally. But I have to admit that I do play favorites. And Yazid is certainly one of mine. Yazid is both sort of the trickster, you know, the universal trickster character that we runs throughout history. And but he's a sort of special type of that, which is the, not to get all literary, but the sort of Falstaff
right
character with large appetites and just physically large and a certain kind of humor and a certain kind of resoluteness. He's not corrupt in the way that Falstaff is. And this guy is quite closely based upon a man who came to work for my father in 1973. So my brother and I were these two runny-nosed little kids. I would have been, you know, 10 years old at the time. And there was this collection of very personality-laden, let's say, Kashmiris, who were my father's, the chauffeur, and my sister's chauffeur, and we were all living together. So they developed this sort of little clan of Kashmiris. Kashmiris, in any case, are always involved in transport in Pakistan. And these guys had set up, were these sort of cool ones in the house. And so the driver is always the cool one because he drives the car. And, you know, he's driving around this fabulous, shiny, of the people, the domestics in the house. And Afra was the coolest of the cool. It was this enormous guy with an even more enormous mustache. And we idolized him. And he was, you know, all the women who worked in the house were in love with him. And he was the master at carom board. And when we got a little bit older, we used to go hunting a lot, and we used to also often go up into the mountains in Pakistan up north. You know, we have some wonderful mountains in Pakistan, and so we would go on these big expeditions every summer, especially once we were at school abroad. We'd come back, and then my brother and I, we'd bring friends with us from abroad, and we'd go up in the mountains. And this was our boon companion. And the only reason I'm still alive today is that Afrasiab had more discretion and wisdom than I did at the age of 17 and 16. So this guy became, you know, continues to be, he still now works for me. He's our longest serving employee. He's been there, he came in 73, so what does that make it, over 50 years that he's been working for us. And he's now sort of emeritus, so he mostly hangs around and tells tall tales, but he's still very much part of our household. And that's where the character began.
Does he know he's found his way into your novel?
Oh, absolutely. No, no, he wouldn't have it any other way. when I was writing the story, I went to him and said, Afrasiab, do you mind? I'm going to write this story about you. And he said, no, do what you like. And I was just 10 days ago, a week ago, I was at my farm and he and I were sitting around teaching my son is 11 years old. So Afra is the master at using weapons. So we were sitting in the garden. It was wonderful to sit in the garden. We were doing target practice with a, you know, with an air rifle and then with a pistol. And I jokingly said to him, Mafra, this reminds me of when I was 10 years old and you were still doing the same thing. Now, all these years later, you are doing it with my son. He loves it. And then I showed him the book. He thought it was very funny. He doesn't read, obviously, in English.
So the character inspired by this is Yazid. He starts as this orphan kid sitting outside this shop holding his shoes. He gets taken in by the shop owner. And this is a character who kind of drags himself along, ends up working as a chauffeur for a landowner family. One thing I do really like about this character of Yazid is how big he is. He's this kind of giant of a man who loves good food, which kind of goes against the traditional idea, I guess, of the starving, skinny orphan. His mere presence in the world is undeniable.
Yeah. Well, remember, he starts as the skinny orphan, but he's soon the guy making the parathas and the chapatis in the tea stall. The one person who's always properly fed in the tea stall is the guy who's making the chapatis. So both in my story and in real life, he's at the spigot when it comes to eating and to delicious food. He's the guy making it. It's like a cook. You rarely see a thin cook in Pakistan. But yeah, it's very important to his character that he be large. I mean, this is a man who's, as I say, he's got biceps the size of a child's waist. And the real Yazid also has biceps the size of a child's waist. There have been several incidents where we were in some dark corner of Pakistan. Some person we were happened to run into became belligerent, and all it requires is for Afrasiab to step out of the car, and suddenly it's 6 feet four by 4 feet of Afrasiab standing next to whoever it is having these threatening posture, and soon that person withdraws.
That's awesome. It's been a while between books for you, Danielle, and I know you started another book, yep. Worked on another book for about 10 years before you came to This Is Where the Serpent Lives. To finish up, can you just tell me, how do you know when a book is not working, and how do you know when a book is working?
That's really interesting, yeah. Well, having written one that wasn't working, you feel it in your gut. I mean, it's sort of like you're trying to animate this thing, and but you know, you keep trying to, you're giving it electric shocks, and it won't start moving. When it works, it clicks into place. And of course, one of the problems with being a writer is that you spend a lot of time thinking and hoping that things are working, and then they aren't, and you have to go back. It's, you know, there's so true what they say about writing, that it's, you know, 10% inspiration, 90% perspiration. You just feel it in your fingers when the thing comes to life. It's sort of like if you make bread, for example, when you're making the dough, at some point you'll feel that it just starts becoming springy and alive. And it's the same thing with fiction. If you're, you know, but when you're writing, you're so deeply absorbed in the work that you're very intimately aware of the liveliness and the tensions within the text, especially as you start playing with it after the first draft. And of course, I kept fooling myself that book was done, and you know, turned it in at one point, and then we were thinking of publishing it, but it wasn't moving, and whereas this thing, you know, and then I've been working on that thing for 10 years and was exhausted by it, and then began this, and immediately, you know, the first story I began was this, you know, Golden Boy, this one with Yazid, and the thing just immediately was like, bling, there was no question whether or not that was alive, and so, you know, it's a finger, you know, sort of a, you can taste it.
Mm. It's a fantastic book. It's called This Is Where the Serpent Lives. It's published by Bloomsbury. Danielle Mouinadine, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Claire.
On ABC Radio National, this is the book show where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. I'm Claire Nichols, and I am taking you from Pakistan to Switzerland now with the Australian author Claire Thomas. Now, I loved Claire's Miles Franklin long-listed novel, The Performance, from 2021. That was about three women all watching the same play. Claire's new book on not climbing mountains is similarly interested in art and experience, But this time, we are taking a series of trains across Switzerland with a woman who has just lost her dad. Claire Thomas, welcome back to The Book Show.
Thank you for having me, Claire. It's lovely to be here.
So, Switzerland, tell me about your relationship with this place.
Look, I didn't have much of a relationship to Switzerland initially, so it's certainly developed in the writing of this project. I was researching what I thought might become a novel, and then I began to notice that a lot of the people that I was kind of interested in had some connection to Switzerland. So it sort of took shape from the ideas that then became placed within that country. And then there was a series of paintings that I loved from a long time ago that are of Swiss train stations. And I'd never forgotten these paintings. And I thought about them again when I was developing this new idea. And it all became quite geographically resonant and connected. And I was like, okay, it seems I am writing a novel about Switzerland.
I'd love to talk about these paintings because they're mentioned a lot in the book too. They're by a Swiss painter called John-Frederick Schneider. The series is called Waiting Room. What do we need to know about these paintings?
Well, there's 92 of them, and he painted them over a reasonably short period of time in the late 80s. And they're of the interiors of small train station waiting rooms and different villages all across Switzerland. And they're all the same size. They're quite, you know, small little oil on canvases. And I saw them in a show in Berlin a long time ago, and they were just rows of them all across the gallery wall. And they captured my imagination because they're so, they're quiet and they're emptied of people, and there's this sort of sense of expectation and possibility in them. And I subsequently established that they were Swiss. I didn't know that initially, and I didn't realise they were train station waiting rooms. So this kind of, they gradually began to make more sense to me after I'd actually seen them. But the almost contrary insistence on focusing on the small, still interior place as opposed to looking outside at the looming dramatic landscapes that we usually associate with Switzerland is, they're very interesting to me in that way. They were evocative of all sorts of things.
It is remarkable. Go, I'm in Switzerland. I'm in all these incredible locations, but I'm not going to paint the mountains.
Yes.
I'm going to paint the room where you sit, where you wait to go and see
exactly,
the mountains.
Exactly. And that sort of sense of repetition and stillness, and obviously a waiting room is just metaphorically so full of potential imaginative and emotional projection. You could just do anything with these little spaces. So I gave my obsession with the paintings to the narrator in my novel, and they become a little bit of a structuring device in the novel, as well as places that she sort of does step inside, in a sense, when she goes to the actual villages themselves.
And one of these paintings, Claire Thomas, is on the cover of
yes,
the novel, On Not
yes.
Climbing Mountains. That's pretty rare to get a work of art like that
yes.
on the cover of a book.
That's right. I was told that it was going to not be possible, and I thought, oh, I'm going to try. And I emailed Schneider's people in Zurich, and they were extremely generous and positive and said, yes, do what you want. And then my publisher was thrilled with that news that I was able to use a painting, but then it was like, well, better check what the fees will be. And then there was no fees, and, you know, it was all a bit dreamy. So we had a choice of 92 paintings to use, and I got the one I wanted for the cover, which I was very excited about. Yes.
That is so fantastic. And you also did a residency in Switzerland while you were writing this book. Can you tell me about that experience?
Yeah. Well, as I said, I was sort of germinating this idea of Switzerland, a novel set in Switzerland. So I applied for this extraordinary residency and was very lucky to be be able to go. It was only 3 weeks, but it was transformative and extremely generous. It's at a place called the Foundation Jan Michalski in the foothills of the Jura. Just really idyllic place. And I clarified, I suppose, what I was doing with this book while I was there. And I realised when I was there that the foundation is actually located in this little village called Montricheur, which happens to be the final site in the final painting in the 92 paintings in the Waiting Room series, which I didn't know until I got there. And I was, you know, there, so there was these moments of, I guess, comforting serendipity that made me think, okay, maybe I should just keep following my nose with this thing that I'm trying to work out. Yeah. And so then I, when I returned from there, it was much clearer. I knew what I was doing.
And there are so many great artists connected to Switzerland. This novel mentions, among others, Charlie Chaplin, Patricia Highsmith, Graham Greene, James Baldwin, Vladimir Nabokov. What do you think it is about this place that has drawn so many great artists and thinkers and writers over the years?
Well, I mean, there's some pragmatic explanations for that. There's, you know, the tax situation is good. Some of them are there for that reason. It's also geographically very close to a lot of other places. It's, you know, there are those kind of dull reasons. I also wanted to look at some of the less obvious people associated with Swiss culture. So there's also actual Swiss artists and writers and thinkers in there. But they've all got quite idiosyncratic reasons for being there. Some of them it's, well, Catherine Mansfield is an example. She came to Switzerland to seek treatment for tuberculosis. There's a lot of that. Charlie Chaplin was escaping McCarthyism in the US. James Baldwin had a Swiss lover who he met in Paris, and then they went to Switzerland together to his lover's kind of family home in an attempt to focus on their art at a point where he hadn't yet completed his first novel. So the stories are really wide-ranging, and that was one of the exciting things, just finding all the differences and the connections between all these people.
What about Mary Shelley? What was her connection to Switzerland?
Well, she was primarily a tourist, and she was a very good tourist, Mary, and she was a good reader, of course, as well. And so she was, her travel diaries in Switzerland are almost like a tracing of Rousseau. So she was very influenced by the writing of Rousseau, and she imagines herself as a character in one of his novels as she's wandering through the Alps. So that's quite an interesting kind of layer. Even then in the early, or the very late 18th century, that was, there was already this template for travel experience in this country that even Mary Shelley was kind of replicating but then trying within that to redefine these spaces for herself. And her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft, had written widely on alpine environments as well. So there was that influence. Yes, and then she stayed famously by the lake in Geneva with Percy Shelley and Byron and a few other people, and it was where she started to work on Frankenstein. So that's a little beautiful glimmer.
Imagine being in that house, my goodness.
Yes, it's quite a moment, yes.
All right, so Claire Thomas, in your novel On Not Climbing Mountains, our narrator, she's riding trains around Switzerland. She's going into some of those waiting rooms that you've talked about the paintings of. Who is our narrator?
Well, she is a person who is interested in being quite peripheral to her experience. She's not overtly seeking out some kind of self-definition. She's grieving. She's lonely. She wants to lose herself, in a sense, in what she begins to obsess over. It's very obsessive and very very distinct to her, what she sort of responds to and chooses to notice or read about or engage with. So from the reader of my novel's point of view, there's a sense of there's an intimacy with her in that there's this kind of consciousness that is filtering this place for the reader. That's what I was hoping to achieve in her as a character. And there's a sort of intimacy with knowing her through her response to this place and its art and its culture. And there's a moment later in the novel where she actually talks about watching someone taking notes about art, and it's the person she's in a relationship with, but she sort of has this sense that knowing what they're feeling about art is the most intimate of all their intimacies. So I like the idea of knowing someone, and it's a kind of a radical intimacy to be inside someone's heart and mind as a way of knowing them, as opposed to just straight up, this is who she is, these are the facts of her. You know, that's gradually becomes apparent through the book, but I deliberately wanted to displace those conventional introductory facts, because within her own consciousness, that stuff is not actually important.
Mm. Mm. You said she's grieving. Her dad has recently died. He was born in Switzerland. So I guess this trip in a way is her trying to reconnect with him or explore his story. I should say we do find out that our narrator's name is Beatrice Angst. Claire Thomas, you've got to know what you're doing giving a character the last name of Angst, surely.
Yeah, well, look, it's a very common surname in Switzerland, and she's aware of it, and she talks a little bit about the quips that she gets when people learn that her name is Angst. Honestly, for me, I like to give my characters names of some resonance, because, you know, Claire Thomas is pretty boring a name, and
I'll defend it for Claire's here.
Well, I mean, I was the second Claire Thomas to visit the ABC just today alone. So there we go. So Beatrice Angst is, it was a deliberately evocative name. She's mainly known as Bee, and there's a lot of actual bees buzzing through this book as well. So there's a symbolism with that that I was interested in. The name doesn't come at the start because, again, she doesn't think about her own name when she's thinking and feeling and watching, and so it sort of just turns up a bit down the track within the book. Yeah.
So the book is called On Not Climbing Mountains, and this is actually a question which is explored many times in the book. If we should actually try to climb mountains, if we should try to conquer mountains. Claire, I thought maybe you could make the case for why we should not climb mountains.
Yes, well, this title has been amusing. People who don't know much about the book, they're sort of straight away like, oh, what have you got against, you know, adventuring or something. So there's the literal thing that does come up in the book. There is mountain climbing and there's a lot of falling off mountains when that is happening. So I think how I would explain what I was, why I wanted to consider these things is that the mountains are a literal space, and they're really interesting in terms of how they're understood as a landmass. And I think it's very, that they're considered to be this huge constant presence, but actually they are vulnerable, and they are changing with climate change. They melt, they explode, they crumble, and all of this stuff. So there's the literal vulnerability of the mountain, but then also all the things that a mountain symbolises or could be synonymous with is sort of what I was interested in too. So the quest for the sake of it, or, you know, the traditional kind of summiting, and then those assumptions around exploration and masculine conquering and colonial domination and all, you know, all of this stuff is there. That human imperative to kind of endlessly progress or to go up is what I'm trying to complicate. And so climbing is, it's its literal thing, but it's synonymous with other kinds of things. Just so I could go on about that for a long time, but it's all of those different ideas.
Well, Claire Thomas, your latest novel is On Not Climbing Mountains. It's published by Hachette. It's been great to chat to you today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
The Book Show is made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. Huge thanks to producers Sarah Lestrange and Anita Barrow. Make sure you are following The Book Show on ABC Listen. My name is Claire Nichols, and until next time, happy reading.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.